You're all very, very welcome to, along tonight to our recording of the book show, coming to you from the Coach House in Dublin Castle on Culture Night. I've been around the castle and around the city, and there's so many people around, it's a great buzz. And we're delighted to have an audience, because we never do, so this is brilliant. We have a wonderful show lined up for you. We have lots of people to talk to. A little later on, we'll be talking to Mike McCormick about his new book, Solar Bones. We'll have a very special recital of a short story by Adrian Crowley with the Crash Ensemble, our lovely musicians here. So lots to look forward to, but first we're going to chat to three of Ireland's leading crime writers, Liz Nugent, Arlene Hunt and Declan Hughes. And for a bit of fun, especially for you tonight, we asked them to write a short story, especially for Culture Night. So each panellist was given a 500-word section or chapter to a short story. So I know this has been done before, Declan, the round-robin idea, but it's not a new form.
No, I think it started, derived in the 19th century, and my most vivid engagement with it was in late 60s, when the playwrights of the kind of 70s in Britain began to write ensemble works. Lay-by was one of their best known, and they were trying to just give the culture a kick and push it along. So it has the potential to make startling effects, but I think we've taken it in a reasonably light-hearted spirit tonight.
Well, I suppose it involves some of the techniques, the key techniques of crime writing. And Liz, first of all, what a week it's been for you, the American book deal and the two-book deal with Penguin. Congratulations. You've now been dubbed the Queen of Suspense or Queen of Crime or something similar.
Yeah, that's because I'm too old to be the princess.
Tell me this. Both people remember from Unraveling Oliver, your first book, the opening line. It was very striking. And you've done this with your new book as well, Lying in Wait. What's the first line of Lying in Wait?
My husband did not mean to kill Annie Doyle, but the lying tramp deserved it.
There you go. So did you kind of, were there other writers who had influenced you in the sort of quest for the great opening line?
Not particularly. It wasn't really opening lines so much as opening scenes. When I was in school, a touring Shakespeare company came to do Macbeth, and they did a scene and then they would talk about it. And that opening scene in Macbeth, when the three witches are on the heath, discussing the fate of the man who's just walked off the battlefield covered in blood. You can't really improve on that. So I guess I learned from the best. I took my cue from Shakespeare and just tried to open with something that's pretty explosive. And also in the aftermath of something extraordinary, that something extraordinary has just happened, and work forwards and backwards from that point.
Arlene, how do you feel about the great opening in crime, and who do you think does it very well or has done it very well?
They used to say when you were teaching crime fiction that if you have to be careful with opening with a really explosive prologue. People get impatient then. The opening prologue is so gripping and it catches you so fast, and then you have to go into sort of more of an explanation as to what happened, and it slows everything all the way back down. And then people expect this. You can see it all the time in reviews and stuff like that. People expect books to kind of keep going up and up and up and up and up in terms of tension. But if you open up with a really, really explosive scene, it's kind of hard to keep everyone's attention then, because you're sort of backpedaling slightly to explain what happened.
The danger, and it's the same danger in all art forms, narrative art forms, is if you grab them too hard, you get a reader who's delighted but is also very impatient. And you have to probably keep moving rather fast. So if there's alternatively, but there's then a technique which is maybe jump forward and fall back, where you go, here's a startling opening, and usually an arresting opening line or a violent act. And
or
then
a body found is the
a body found. Yeah, but then you slow right back down again, secure in the knowledge that you have everybody's attention, and you can take time.
I guess if you open by grabbing the reader by the throat, you have to hold them there for the whole book.
At least strangle them.
You're putting yourself under huge pressure now, because yours is the first section in the story. All we did was we asked the writers, it had to be 500 words and set on Culture Night. So tell us the background to how you started. What did you do?
What I've always done with every piece of writing I've ever done is come up with a character first. And I have a voice. So I came up with the voice of this dissatisfied female character.
Let's hear her.
Culture Night. Yeah, right. I knew that town would be crawling with arseholes, lovies doing street theatre, and fellas who couldn't draw a straight line putting squiggles on a canvas and calling it art. None of those gobshites would know what a real job was. They don't know what it's like to work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, chained to a desk, working for Mr. Kenny. Mr. Kenny, the lecherous pig who had tried to stick his hand up my skirt at the summer barbecue. Mr. Kenny, who had insisted that I come with him to this culture night event. Mr. Kenny, who had not so subtly implied that my salary review depended on it. And now, here we were, crammed into this overheated tent, waiting for a poet nobody ever heard of to wax lyrical. Mr. Kenny moved his thigh closer to mine on the bench. "Isn't this lovely?" he shouted in my ear. "I love poetry." I knew he thought this would impress me because I once made the mistake of saying in the office that I'd won a poetry competition when I was in school. I'd only said it because I was trying to impress Carl in IT, who'd said he was working on a novel. Carl, of the deep green eyes and the sexy grin. Carl, who said if he weren't married to Lynn, that I'd be the girl for him. "I wandered lonely as a cloud," said Mr. Kenny. "Do you know that one? That's my favourite." I moved my thigh aside and crossed my legs. "Fine pins you have, so you have," said Mr. Kenny. I turned my head away to hide my disgust, but out of the corner of my eye, I spotted a familiar shape standing at the bar, leaning up against Gronja from sales. Carl gave her his sexy grin and ran his finger from her chin down her throat to the low neckline of her blouse. He led her towards two seats at the back, out of my eyeline, behind a pillar. The plastic glass in my hand contracted as I realized I had involuntarily crushed it. Mr. Kenny nudged me as a scruffy young man sloped towards the microphone and introduced himself. "Hi. My name is Stephen Mullen, and I'm going to read for you a short poem I wrote last week." He cleared his throat arrogantly and began. "My heart is cracked in two. My mood is coloured blue. Why, oh why, oh why, oh why cannot I have you? You and I were one. We had so much fun. Your face is like the sun. Please pass me the gun." I was confused momentarily. How had this asshole gotten hold of my prize-winning poem? My hand closed around the kitchen knife at the bottom of my bag. Maybe there would be more than one murder on this culture night.
So, Liz, what kind of character is she, and how important is character?
I think she's somebody who's very dissatisfied with her life, with her job. Because this is only 500 words, and I didn't have to wrap it up, I actually didn't put too much thought into it. Like, Arlene and Declan had the really difficult jobs of following this and, you know, making a coherent story out of it. So I kind of wrote this in an afternoon. I'm sorry I didn't put that much thought into it. But I just wanted this sort of person who just thinks that culture night is a load of balls and, you know, that she wasn't afraid to say it.
Declan, what kind of techniques did you spot that Liz is using here? I mean, the confined space is always very interesting for crime, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. And because I came third, I had to try and wrap everything up. So it was basically, I was doing maths as much as I was doing writing. I was like counting people, figuring out who might be significant. And obviously, and then Arlene had named this lady Angelica. So she was pretty vocal. And the affair or lack of one or possible one between her and her boss was one of the things that I lit on because, you know, poetry, culture, sex. I mean, really, it's an obvious sense of those connections. Yeah.
Arlene, Liz opened up lots of kind of avenues. There's loads of ways this can go, and it's less of a who done it than the why done it, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. I was kind of lucky to come second because Liz had kind of given me the bones of who this woman was, and I decided instead of just going off in a completely different angle, I wanted to focus in on her, so I named her and I fleshed her around a little bit, and I put a little bit of a question mark over her moral ambiguities, because I thought
Angelica is the perfect name.
I thought it just really suited her. I just thought Angelica, because, you know, it could be, you know, heavenly or demonical, whichever way you want to look at her. And that's kind of what I sort of did in the second half. So it kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier on. We let it kind of open with more of an explosive opening. So now I'm just trying to flesh in the bits, because I knew head the ball here and roll it up nicely.
But you kind of got the heavy lifting. I mean, the opening is that everyone's immediately interested. The end, you got to tie it all up. So you've got the hard work in the middle. So where did you go?
I literally just fleshed them out. I just put flesh onto the characters and put a little bit of a question mark over everybody. And I added in a sort of supporting cast to it, so that we're still keeping our focus on Angelica, because she's the girl, but I'm adding more to her. But I'm also giving the perspective of somebody else, somebody else's perspective about Angelica as well. So by the time, hopefully, the ending comes along, we'll be very much focused on her, but we'll have our doubts about her. She won't be good or bad, but she could be, the possibilities of what she could be are endless.
Well, let's hear part two and Angelica.
I'd hardly call this culture, Iris said, as she sat down and looked disdainfully around at the crowd filling into the net. Culture, my eye. Keep your voice down, ma'am, I said, blushing as a number of heads turned our way. What? I said, will you keep your voice down? She sniffed and tutted, glaring at a happy-faced toddler that wandered too close to her seat. I unwrapped my scarf and sat down, trying to relax a little. She's your mother, I reminded myself. Breathe. Why did she always have to be so bloody loud? Why could she never, just once, maybe, be happy about something? No matter what I did or where I took her or what I said, nothing was ever good enough for her. I wouldn't mind, but I bend over bloody backwards to include her in my life, not like my brother Gerard. And yet it's him whose praises she sings. Oh, Gerard has a lovely new car. Oh, did you hear? Gerard's going to Florida with Violet and the children. Oh, Gerard got promoted. Did you hear? Did I hear? Sure, how could I not hear? Gerard, bloody Gerard, the only topic of conversation she was happy to have these days. I felt a sharp elbow in my side and tried not to wince. There's that Duggan one. I didn't think she'd show her face around here. Who? Angelica Duggan, Dimna Duggan's daughter. Ah, you know her. Sure, didn't you work together one summer at the hotel with her? I followed my mother's eye and found myself staring at an attractive redhead in a dark green coat. She was sitting beside a bald man who was sweating up a storm and gazing fondly at her legs. I don't know her. Indeed and you do, Iris snapped. Right little tramp she used to be. Wasn't she the one that had the fling with your man from the hotel? Do you not remember? Sure, it was their eruptions when the wife found out. I wrinkled my brow, feeling vague threads of memory knot together. Summer, sneaking fags out the back of the hotel kitchen. Oh God, it was her, Angelica. We hadn't been friends, not really. Angelica had been a bit older than me, about 2 years, and impossibly cool. She had both ears pierced 3 times, smoked menthol cigarettes, and she rode a moped. Oh, yeah, I said. Now I remember her. On stage, a scruffy young man grabbed the microphone, cleared his throat, introduced himself, and began to read a poem. I felt the elbow again. Would you look at the puss in her, Iris hissed. I glanced across, getting ready to snap, but Iris was right. Angelica was staring up at the poet with an ugly expression on her face. The poet rambled on, pausing here and there for dramatic effect. When he was done, he bowed, turned to walk off the stage, but he had barely taken 2 steps when there was a blood-curdling scream and all hell broke loose.
Flesh. Nice cliffhanger, so Declan's got it all to do with the final section. Arlene, you're about to deliver a new book yourself, a book that's set in the US. What can you tell me about it?
The newest one, which is due in, actually it's going to the publishers there in October 4th. I say that, we'll see whether it gets there or not. It's based in a small coastal town in Northern America, overlooking the Atlantic. It is based on the interactions between people in a small town with a very, it's a small population, only 10,000 people. Everybody knows everybody else. Everyone knows, well, they think they know everybody else. Everyone knows everyone's history. They've grown up together. A lot of people would have gone to school together. But as you find with a lot of small towns, there's a lot of secrets buried there. And we meet the town a couple of weeks just before the one of the worst storms to ever hit the town, and the town is closed off from much of the rest of the state. So lots of things are going to come to the surface, and it's going to be incredibly unpleasant.
I know, Declan, I think Ed Loy, who's a character of yours, he's been to the US as well, and he's the sort of, your work involves an observer, and I think a lot of great detectives have been, whether that's Miss Marple, people just with good eyes and ears. There's a lot of great detectives in fiction, but there's often detectives with a lot of flaws and faults. And we had Ian Rankin on the show recently. He was talking about Rebus, who's got, well, he's just loads of bad habits. Yeah. What are the habits that Ed has? Is he sort of particularly flawed? Do they have to be to solve these crimes, get into this darkness?
Well, he's an alcoholic. Hmm. Not acknowledged as such, but the level he drinks at, he's trying to do the right thing. And I mean, he has a lot of the classic conditions of a hard-boiled detective. And I think they're there for a reason. And the reason is to sort of put the actions he takes in isolation from anything else in his life. So usually the life is a disaster, but the actions almost become redemptive as a result. And I mean, I've introduced a detective in this story to round things up because I couldn't think of any other way to figure it out. There's a sort of gentle allusion to his bad habits, but it's more affectionate than kind of a profound exploration of character.
So where did you go with it, and how difficult was it to tie up the loose ends?
Well, it seemed to me to be a divorce case. It seemed to me that there was, you know, the intrigue, the couples, the not just the Kennys. Well, I thought about his wife, and then also there's Carl from IT with Gráinne, and then the sexy grin, and then this browbeaten daughter who was a gift from Arlene. And I thought, okay, she's got to play a significant role. And so then you're trying to corral. I mean, I couldn't get Gerard in. You know, he might have driven past in a fancy limousine or something, but you're trying to corral as many of the people in. And it's not dissimilar. I mean, you usually have a plan when you start out, so certainly by the time you get to the end, you're more familiar with your characters. But a certain amount is possibilities. And you are aware also with a crime novel, with a mystery, that a reader will be reading as well, for at a certain point they'll go, oh, it's either A or B, or it's A, B, or C. And so I did something as well with the focus is drawn to the stage and is drawn to the knife. And I thought, okay, what you're trying to do is surprise, is be logical and kind of coherent insofar as the characters you've been presented with are available in the situation, but also introduce the element of surprise. So readers will be, oh, I didn't see that coming, but actually it kind of makes sense, you know.
Okay, well, we're all on the edge of our seat here. So let's hear the final section of our Culture Night story.
Okay. I didn't used to do divorce work, but in this economy, only the rich can afford to divorce, and I still prefer to get paid in actual money. They're older than they used to be, now that Viagra has extended a man's natural lechery span by a good 20 years. The Kennys were in their 60s. His wife laid it out in pictures. It's either Angelica Duggan or Gráinne Clear, she said. Younger women, God knows what they see in him, and I don't care. I want him gone. Beer belly, medicated Mickey, the works. The only thing is, Lynn, see, that's my best friend Iris's daughter. Rumours there, her husband Carl misbehaving. Of course, Lynn is hopeless, not like her mother at all. Clear it up without Iris knowing. So, two jobs for you. Think you can manage? Three things that scare me in this life. Tents, poets, and truthful women. And there I was on Culture Night, in the first, surrounded by the second, and pretty sure none of the women I could see would tell me lies. I saw Kenny sweating beside Angelica, who looked like she'd eaten a bad mussel. It wasn't her. I saw Gráinne around the back, making out with geeky Carl, who had a man bun. It wasn't her. A soft-spoken poet in a big jumper was replaced by an angry poet in a leather jacket no one could avoid. I looked at Kenny. He was wiping his brow and making his face do relaxed smiles that weren't relaxed, and casting regular sidelong glances over my shoulder. I turned around, and there they were, mother and daughter both. Iris was beige and snooty with drop earrings and a turban. Overdressed much? Lynn, though, a little faded, a little wan, Lynn oblivious to what man-bun Carl was getting up to behind her back, Lynn smiling anxiously towards Kenny. Lynn was the one. Just enough low self-esteem to be flattered by an old lecher's attention. The poets changed again, and my attention strayed to Angelica. I like redheads. They're closer to their crazy than civilians, and they rarely tell the truth. Lost in my reverie, I wasn't looking at the stage when a blood-curdling scream rang out. When I sat up, Angelica was on her feet. "You sold my poem, you tech rat!" Angelica screamed and charged towards Carl. Lynn turned, saw Grania springing back from her husband, and followed. I stepped in and plucked the knife from Angelica's swinging hand. The blow landed all the same, and Carl dropped to his knees. I handed the knife to Lynn. "Do the right thing," I said. One slice, and Carl's man bun dropped to the floor in a frothy puddle. I followed Kenny out of the tent, across the park, and took my photos of him behind a copse of trees. The woman was older, as it turned out. His wife's best friend, Iris. It cost him every penny. Me, I found Angelica and gave her back her knife and bought her wine, and she told me all the lies I could have hoped for.
Thank you, Declan. Thank you, all of you. How do you all feel, the three of you, about endings? Because I know that, is there a more expectation of the writer to kind of come up with the goods at the ending, as there isn't in maybe other novels or literary fiction? And do you know the ending before you start? I know that John Irving, who isn't a crime writer, but said that he can't write a book until he knows what the last line is. So do you prefer to be surprised when you're in the middle of writing it, or do you have to know what's going to happen at the end?
Vague idea what's going to happen at the end. I usually know who is the culprit. It's the getting there is the hard work. that's the problem. Openings are great, and you know the endings are great. It's just when you have all your plates are up in the air just to get from this opening to the ending. That's the hard part.
The long middle.
Middle part is the hard part.
Tricky.
Liz, what about you?
With Unraveling Oliver and Lying in Wait, I just kind of made it up as I went along, and the ending arrived. With this one, the one I'm working on at the moment, I have an ending in mind, and I don't know if it's going to survive, but it's pretty savage, because everybody said, you know, the ending of Lying in Wait is so dark that really I've nowhere to go but dark. So I think I'm going to have to go even further into the depths of the darkness to find the ending for this one.
And has the publisher ever said to you, no, it's too dark, you got to line that up, you got to change it?
No, the opposite.
Darker?
The opposite, yeah. Lying in Wait in its first draft was a comedy noir novel, and my publishers told me I couldn't make up my own genre. So apparently comedy noir doesn't exist yet. So I had to darken it down and take out all the stuff that I thought was hilarious and she thought was mildly amusing. Yeah.
What do you all feel about, there's been an undoubted rise in Irish crime fiction over the last 10 or 15 years, and there's been lots of speculation as to why that is, but why do you feel that a lot of names have come to the fore? And obviously Declan Burke has a new anthology coming out as well of crime writing. What's behind it?
I'm not sure. All I can say is the more the merrier. Bring it on. It's great. And it's great that there's so many of us now that we have a brand. We are now Emerald Noir that is being marketed in the same way as Scandi Noir would have been previously. So it's good for all of us. And I don't know why it is. I don't know if it's recession-based or...
I think the Celtic Tiger had something to do with it, but I think that as valid a question is why wasn't there more of it beforehand, you know? So the rise of realistic fiction, of a sense of taking for granted Ireland as a society rather than an identity question. But, you know, at this point, you know it's arrived when... I'm back from New York. There was an event at NYU this week where there's a collection of academic essays about Irish crime fiction been published. So the academics have got their claws into us. So, we must actually exist.
Very quickly, if somebody wanted to write crime fiction, what advice would you give them?
Read crime fiction.
Same.
Yeah. Find the writers that you really like, and, you know, every writer starts off kind of copying before they find their own voice, but make sure it's copying somebody that you feel connected with, yeah?
Who did you copy?
Initially Ross MacDonald, yeah.
Anybody else going to own up to any copying? No.
I totally plagiarised John Banville's Book of Evidence.
You heard it here first. You'd probably be happy to hear that.
He'd be disgusted to be I think to be referred to as a crime writer. He's
interesting,
not a crime writer.
That you said John Bavel, not Benjamin Black.
Yeah, because the Book of Evidence was like the start of Book of Evidence is pretty much like the start of Unraveling Oliver. You know, the crime has been committed, and then it's an exploration of the psychology of the criminal. But obviously, he does it in a much more dexterous and much more fluent way than I do it. I'm just no ham. Yeah.
And we say emulation or homage, you know. I mean, by the time, in your exercises, by the time you actually get to find your own voice, you know, you've left that behind.
Okay. Yeah. On that note, my thanks to Liz, to Arlene, and to Declan. Lying in Wait by Liz Nugent is published by Penguin Ireland. All the Things You Are by Declan Hughes is published by Severn House. And Arlene Hunt's Last to Die is out now in paperback, but book outre. Earlier this year, Mike McCormack's third novel, Solar Bones, was published to much acclaim. Mike is also the author of two story collections and two further novels, but we're here to talk about your latest book, which is Solar Bones. The main character is Marcus. He's kind of someone that we don't hear a lot from, I think, in fiction, in that he's quite middle class and quiet and unassuming. Why did you make him an engineer?
Because I have a fascination with people who can make the world. Writers write about the world, and painters paint the world, and photographers photograph the world, but engineers make the world. And how many of us have read a book about an engineer? How many of us have read a novel about an engineer? We've all read books about killers and murderers and that. And how many of us has met a killer, a murderer? But I presume that all of us at some stage or other has had transaction with engineers and the work that they do. And I'm a big admirer of what they do. They're responsible for the signature of our times. They're responsible for our roads and our libraries and our hospitals and that. And the world, you know, history will look back and see these things and say that this is what we valued. This is what we put our name to. This is what we thought was part of civil and civic society. And all of those things came together in the person or the character of Marcus Conway, who's in his early 50s and from Lewisburg in County Mayo, and who's one day quite baffled, blundering around in his own kitchen. And the novel takes off from there.
Was the fact that he was an engineer and so much has happened in Ireland in terms of building and construction, and was he connected to the idea of the changing Ireland and what's gone on here?
Partially, I think the book, people have commented on the book that it's a kind of post-Celtic crash novel and that. And that's just the background against which he has his work and his life and that. It's really the book was Marcus, first of all, and everything that happens, the greater, you know, economic and social thing that happens around him and that. That's the ambient background against which he has his being and his life. That said, I suppose one question that did prompt him into being that I've always asked is, I've always wondered what engineers and architects were doing during the Celtic Tiger, how they signed off on so many questionable projects. And that was one of, if you ask enough questions, someone will step forward as a writer. If you ask enough questions, someone will step forward with some sort of an answer to those questions. And I think I'd asked those questions long enough that Marcus Conway sort of stepped forward and says, I think I might have an answer to it, and here's what happened. And that's how I found myself talking to him for, I think, about 5 years in all. That's what went into the making of Solar Bones.
When he does start to speak, and this is one of the most striking aspects of the book, he speaks in one continuous sentence. And I'm wondering, how easy is it to dispense with grammar, to take out the full stops, to take out the commas and the semicolons? And do you think that that kind of adds momentum and sort of, you know, there's a strange transition? I mean, there's a reason, I'm guessing, for you choosing that voice and that way to tell the story.
Yeah, it's no... Right from the beginning, the reader knows that Marcus is dead, and the Marcus himself doesn't know he's dead. It takes him the full book to remember that, and but the reader knows it, and so the reader has this knowledge of him before he comes to this himself. And So I knew it quite early on in the writing of the book on that. And once I realized that he was a ghost and that, it seemed to me really obvious thing that ghosts would have no business with full stops, that they would, a ghost might fatally falter at a full stop, and that they would seek continuance and ongoingness on that. And so once I had that, then it's kind of picked up this kind of systolic ongoingness, the systolic rhythm and that, and this kind of synaptic, kind of sometimes twitching in places and everything like that, but continuously ongoing and that. An attempt, I had written four books that are kind of chiseled and forensically attentive and kind of exact in their sentences. And I was very aware that something slobbery about life was falling outside of those chiseled sentences and that. So how do I get around that? One of the ways of getting around that is write a big, wide, capacious novel. But I don't have the rhythms or the energies for that. So what I thought was, I'll write a big sentence instead and see how I get around that.
We don't
that.
Have time for the whole sentence, but could we hear some of that sentence?
Yeah, okay. This is Marcus, a pivotal moment in his childhood where he comes home one day and he finds that his father has dismantled the tractor in the hayshed. And I stood in the doorway in my school trousers and jumper, terrified at the sight, because to one side lay the body of the 35, gutted of its most essential parts and forlorn now, its components ordered across the floor in such a way as to make clear not only the sequence of its dismantlement, but also the reverse order in which it would be restored to the full working harmonic of itself. And my father standing over the whole thing, sighting through a narrow length of fuel line, blowing through it till he was satisfied that it was clean through its length before he laid it on the floor, giving it its proper place in the sequence and explaining to me, saying simply, it was burning oil. As if this was some sort of viral malfunction, likely to spread from the machine itself and infect the world's wider mechanism, throwing the universe itself out of kilter to bring it crashing down through the heavens. Because I knew well that this dismantlement went beyond a fitter's examination of a diesel engine, well beyond stripping out the carburetor to clean the jets. Once again, my father had succumbed to the temptation to take something apart just to see how it was put together, to know intimately what he had put his faith in. As he stood over this altar of disassembly, with nothing in his hand but a single open-ended spanner which he waved over the assemblage as if it were a gesture of forgiveness. And when he told me that this single tool was capable of breaking down the entire tractor, dismantling the whole thing to its smallest components, and that it was then sufficient in itself to put it back together again without need of any other instrument, my fear only deepened as I recalled at the thought that something so complex and highly achieved as this tractor engine could prove so vulnerable, so easily collapsed and taken apart by this single tool. And so frightened was I by this fact, it would be years afterwards before I could acknowledge the engineering elegance of it all and see it as my father did, something graceful and beautifully conceived, not the instrument of chaos it presented itself as to my childish imagination. And this may have been the first moment of anxious worry about the world, the first instance of my mind spiraling beyond the immediate environs of hearth, home, and parish towards the wider world beyond, way beyond.
Mike, it's really striking that the father-son relationship is really central in this book. I know from reading your past work that it's there. So why is it something that you go back to?
Yeah, you're right. It's a theme that I seem to... Your pen has a certain gravity and it always pulls towards certain themes. And one of the recurring themes in my books are father-son relationships. I lost my father very suddenly when he was 46 or 47. He came home from a funeral one night. He went out for a few pints one night early in the week, and the man who was beside him got a heart attack and died. And he went to his funeral a couple of nights later, and he had a few pints, and he came home and he died in his bed. And so I was 18 at the time, so it left a big impression on me. So one of the things, and I don't have much control over it, it's just, as I say, a gravity that's in the pen. My pen defaults to this theme again and again, and it's I would say that it's slightly different in the run of Irish fathers in novels. They tend to be oppressive and overbearing characters, but I think I give my fathers a good rap in the books. They tend to be well-meaning, loving men who are sources of wisdom and good counsel, but tendency to be slightly awkward and maladroit by time.
Yeah, and Marcus is close to his son. They have that, it's long distance, but very close relationship.
They do, actually. I forgot, actually, that there is that three-way male thing going on in it, and that, yeah, there's grandfather, father, and son in it. Yeah, he has this distance. His son is a beloved son, but he's a great man for annoying his old fella as well as any son worth his salt is. Yeah.
It's been great to see the success of this book, and you were very successful quite early on in your career. You won the Rooney Prize, you were with Jonathan Cape, and then you were unpublished for a decade, and you've come back with quite a daring and very... inventive, and not the kind of book that a lot of people would dare to try. Did you have any kind of sense that, you know, if you're going to make a comeback, it has to be with something maybe that people might think is more mainstream?
Yeah, no. One of the more ashen definitions of artistic freedom is having no publisher. You're free to do anything you want then. And, you know, it was Olaf Turnson who asked me this, did I feel successful as a writer? And I said I did, because even though I only sold a handful of books, I wrote the books that I want to, I've written the books that I want to write, whatever shape or form they came to me. And this is the book that I wanted to write. It's the book that presented itself to me, and that's as much thought as I gave to it. And that really, when I sit down to write a book, my guiding intention is, if the book could write itself, how would it write itself? In what shape or form would it make? Would it achieve its own being? And I try to achieve that in the book. And so that's really it. But as I say, if you want to be free, have no publisher. It's quite a liberating place to be. There were certain times when I didn't have a publisher, and when I was thinking, this isn't too bad at all. It's a place where no one's going to be looking over my shoulder and telling me that I can't do this or that or the next thing.
Well, I'm grateful that you did it. It's great to see the book out in the world. And if you'd like to read Mike's book, Solar Bones by Mike McCormack is published by Tram Press. Now, finally this evening, we've come in from all the crowds and the busyness outside, and we've had an awful lot of talking now, so I think it's time that we might actually take some music. We're going to go and visit a place called the Dead Hotel. Adrian Crowley is better known to many of us as a musician, but has recently devised a piece, As the Sun Rises on a Crooked Arm, and is an extract from his new Dark Fiction. Is it okay to say Dark Fiction? A piece called The Dead Hotel. He's worked with Ireland's leading new music ensemble, the Adventurous, Innovative, and very, very ambitious Crash Ensemble, to devise a soundscape for this piece. So with Adrian, we're going to have Corvinus Lunny on violin, Lisa Dowdall on viola, Kate Ellis on cello, Deirdre O'Leary on clarinet, Chris Dines on percussion, with Adrian Crowley on voice. So settle in now for the end of the show, this aural treat, which is called The Dead Hotel.
It was as if the tumble-down mansion had asked to be left alone and pull the hillside around itself like a tired child gathers up a blanket and falls asleep. And the sleep was deep, black, and untroubled, for decades rain fell on the roof slates, paint peeled on the rows of white balustrades, on the many balconies, under long, punishing heat waves. Starlings made their nests in the chimney tops, foxes bore their litters in the corners of bedrooms or in open drawers or wardrobes of the Dead Hotel. Shutters half open and hanging from hinges invited ivy to creep in through broken window panes and cast dappled light shadows on the buckling floorboards inside the dead hotel. And loose stones in time found their settling place, falling from the overhang of the hillside that cast its shadow on the old hotel to cover croquet lawns. And fill statued fountains with silt, the same fountains that once trapped the sun rays and cast tiny rainbows in the spray of its babbling cascade. What splendid sea views these rooms once boasted, what wondrous sunlight, the solarium trapped in time for those visitors passing and stopping for a while. Writing on postcards in the morning, sipping coffee from bone china cups and falling asleep on a chaise longue in the dead hotel. Ah, the same bone china that now lends its scattered chips and shards to the bones of mice or fallen nests and broken twigs that cover tables in the dining halls. Silver carafes filled with leeches and rainwater and great chunks of plaster broken free from the ceiling above. Frog spawn flicks and twitches in the porcelain of the dark scullery in the dead hotel. What of the once magnificent flying staircase that now sags and leans and groans under its own magnitude? The carved posts and banisters coiled with weeds and poison ivy and hunting scenes in wood choked and covered by sinews and roots. A lone silver birch pierces the staircase and stretches high and wide its branches and leaves, kissed by the occasional sunlight that falls from the skylight high above. And bats, of course, the bats, how they cavort and chase each other at dusk, waking from every corner and chamber, from under stairs and bookcases. Their tomes scattered asunder, their sagging pages fallen and covered in mold, their pictures and illustrations faded to the limit of recognition. A portrait of a lady in ermine fur, and in the stairwell, walls glistening with a thin skin of rainwater in the dead hotel. There hangs an oil painting of a tall man brandishing a musket over a fallen stag, the canvas agleam with the silver lines left by snails and slugs. Oblivious to the masterful brushstrokes they cover with their slime, with their slime. And what of the pavilion on the former lawn, once a midnight trysting place, what nubile beauty was wooed here? and seduced out of her nightdress, her dark hair covered in sweat and sticking to her lover's neck as they grind and smack in hurried anguish. Under the spangle of starlight and amid the trickling of fountain water from stone urns, as statuettes stand all watching from the covered arcades. Unfazed by the passion before them, unashamed anyway by their own half-nakedness, now that same pavilion is home to thorns and wild orchids. Thick nests of caterpillar and thistle and nettle and woodbine and honeysuckle, all those hardy victors of a forgotten walled garden. And in the entrance hall, the concierge desk, now covered in soot and dust so deep it could be measured in inches, if one was in the mind to measure the depth of dust. All keys still hanging on hooks on a buckled mahogany cabinet, the numbers still visible on brass keyrings in the dead hotel. All the numbers, sevens and sixes, twos and fours, double threes and 100s, 400s and 200s and so on. Some still a glimmer, some long since lackluster, but all long since estranged and ultimately divorced from their partner locks and keyholes. And what of the rows of deep cubbyholes once used for letters and notes, parcels and gifts, epistolary words written in haste? Some envelopes are still unopened, barely visible through thick veils of cobwebs, and house martin and swallow, tawny owl and eagle owl all make their nests here now. The brass numbers above each square hole still legible, the humor of house numbers lost on all of them, their guano piled thick on the parquet floor of their would-be doorstep in the dead hotel. And speaking of birds, what became of them, those tamed peacocks that once strutted here on the mown grass and on the roofs of the pavilion and covered walkways? That rare and prized breed, white albino peacock, all unfurling of tail feathers in a chalk-white display of pride and courtship. Well, their ghostly plumes and white feathers still can be seen here and there, scattered and suspended in stairwells, half-floating in green fish ponds. And speaking of fish, what became of those young golden carp who had also become tame and used to the shadows and silhouettes of the guests at the dead hotel, hoping for a bready offering, some crouton, some pain au chocolat perhaps, always kissed asunder with eager lips and devoured with smacks and splashes? Well, their descendants have long since found a home in the quarry, carried along by floodwaters and overflow, grown to greater girths now, and mingling the blood-stained gold in the dark waters, stained by the earth and by the ashes from gorse fires and mudslides, from gorse fires and mudslides. But now, today, as if by some kind of trickery, divine or diabolical, seven white peacocks have appeared and perch on the wrought iron and weed and tangled gates that lead to the Dead Hotel. Their cries fill the early morning as the sun rises, as the sun rises on Crooked Arm.
Wow, what music to send you off into the dark on Culture Night. I'm sure, thanks so much for that. And that's all we have time for tonight on our special Culture Night edition of the Book Show. Thanks so much to Crash Ensemble and to Adrian Crowley, to Cora Venus-Lunny, Lisa Dowdall, Kate Ellis, Deirdre O'Leary, Chris Dines, and of course, Adrian Crowley again. Thanks again to all of tonight's guests and to the RTE Culture Night production team of Penny Rose Hart, Rachel Breslin, Sarah Binchy, and on sound, Joe Bean and Richard McCullough. The Book Show team, huge thanks to Norma Burke, to Regan Hutchins, and to Zoe Cummins. So we're back on air at the usual time, only for half an hour, sadly, at 7 o'clock next Saturday night.